Here. Right. So welcome to the second lecture of the optical spectroscopy course. So this is we are recording this again, and hopefully this time we can get it in Moodle afterwards so that you can see. So the topic today is a review of important quantum mechanical results, which we use then later in the course. And this is the second lecture, and this is the first of the advanced level of the course. So the idea is that for the basic course, and that means the Tuesday lectures, we soon start going through different kinds of spectroscopies. It's a bit more close to the practical spectroscopy, and then on Thursday lectures we go more deeply into theory, trying to explain the phenomena from the theoretical point of view better. And if you think about molecules, whenever you measure a spectrum, let's say you measure infrared spectrum, you see a lot of peaks, and every peak is a manifestation of a quantized energy level. So that means that molecules are completely quantum mechanical objects. So in order to understand the spectra, we have to use quantum mechanics. So that's why it is important on this course. Okay, so we have no participants online at the moment. So then we go to the lecture. So some of you are taking the quantum mechanics course at the moment. This is good, this is fine. But the purpose here is to basically short review of time independent quantum mechanics, some key results, some and a little in the beginning, a little bit of algebra, which will be used later on the course. So this so we will go through this Kelly book, which is here in a physical form, but this is, as I mentioned, this is available as ebook, so you can access it. Today we will go chapter one, some parts of it, and then some parts of chapter two. First is review of time independent quantum mechanics, and then second is about electromagnetic radiation. So a little bit additional material compared to the last lecture. So I can actually circulate this, so you can take a look how it looks. So we are going to go through some parts of this book, and whenever I refer to Kelly book, it's this one. Okay, so the first thing to start with is a state function. So I use here this notation of the Kelly book in order to get familiar with it. So state function, that means that whenever we have any quantum mechanical system or object, it is described with a wave function. And if we know the wave function, we can calculate any property of the system. And here, usually we use psi for the symbol of the wave function. Of course, it's in reality, it is something very complicated function. And it's here it is given as a function of position. So basically it can contain many coordinates here, R1, R2, R3, so on. And these can be coordinates of particles like electrons or nuclei. And if there are many electrons, many nuclei, this is in principle very complicated function. So it's usually we don't know the exact form of the function. It's only in very rare cases. So basically R refers to position. So it's a vector in space of particle I. Okay, so that's a starting point. And usually we don't know the trajectories of all particles, but we know the probabilities of the particles. And this is what the wave function describes. And the probability that the particle is in an infinitesimal volume element around any coordinate R1 and so on is given by this. So it's a kind of a square of the wave function. So that gives probability. That is something we can already measure. The wave function itself, in principle, is not something we can observe, but the square of it, the probability is. Okay. Now, important thing is the scalar product. So the inner product, and now we already have two different representations here. The first one shows that this is an integral. So if we have two functions, psi and phi, the scalar product is a product of the functions, so that on the left, we have a complex conjugate of the function, and then it is integral over all coordinates. So that is the scalar product or inner product. And on the right-hand side, we have this Dirac notation, which is, first of all, it's a useful and compact notation for this kind of integrals, but it's also can be considered as a system by itself, so that we can consider this, for example, here two sides, the right-hand side and the left-hand side, where the left-hand side is called Bra vector and the right-hand side is Ket vector, that these are vectors. Okay, so we can, so inner product is a product of two vectors. Okay, but basically, whenever we have this this kind of Dirac notation, it can be also remembered that in principle it means this kind of integral. Okay. Now, in quantum mechanics, so if the system is in state psi, it can also be in state phi, and the probability is given by this square of the inner product. Okay. Now, this is important now. A representation. It's basically a set of basis vectors. So here we have psi, and usually psi is something which is very complicated, we don't know. But we can represent it with a series of simpler functions. So this here is a psi is a sum of u functions with coefficient c. So this is basically series, in principle infinite series. And this is used all the time in quantum mechanics, and that's why the how we do algebra with this kind of representations is important. And for example, here psi could be a wave function for nuclear motion of an unharmonic oscillator. Okay, but this is a bit complicated, and then the u could be a function of harmonic oscillator. And harmonic oscillator wave functions, we can know all of them. So then we represent this more complicated unharmonic oscillator function as a series of harmonic oscillator functions. That's the philosophy here. And coefficients C, they are in principle complex numbers. Oops. And here is just a trick, it's called closure. It is used a lot. So reading from the left, we have basically two inner products, product of two inner products, where the ket vector of the left-hand side and the bra vector of the right-hand side are the same basis functions. And then if we take series I over it, it is basically equal to one. So this part series over this central part is one. So that is same as the inner product of the phi and psi here. So it is used in two ways. When, for example, when we have something expression like this on the left, you can recognize it and then you can get rid of it, so and get a more simple expression. Or you have this inner product, and for some reason you want to manipulate the algebraic, and you insert this closure there. Sometimes we do this. So the left part is a discrete representation. So that means that we have a discrete set of functions, function 1, 2, 3, 4 up to infinity. And on the right hand side, we have a infinite, or we have continuous representation. So it's integral. But the same thing for continuous representation, basically functions. Not discrete, but basically continuous, then we have an integral, or on the left-hand side, we have sum. So this is a useful relation to use. Now we use a lot, or Kelly book uses a lot, this matrix form of the representations. And there, the state vector is given by a column vector. I will explain soon a bit more. And the complex conjugate is given by a row vector. So here we have components. Here on the column vector, we have first component is the inner product of U1 basis vector with the psi function. Second component is U2 with the psi wave function and so on. And in the complex conjugate, we have the same components, but now other way around, so that we have the phi function as a bra vector and mu basis function as a ket vector. And this, we have all the components also there. So that means that we can do matrix calculation. If we take inner product, we can calculate this in a matrix algebra. So now, and I could actually go through this. Just a second. So for the second, let's consider these elements of this vector U1. Side. So, for example, let's for the moment say that our psi is a series of two components. That's for the simplicity. C1 U1 plus C2 U2. Normally, it is, of course, it could be up to infinite, but here it is just the two components. So we could, in a vector notation or Dirac notation, we could write it in this way, that it's C1 times U1 plus C2 times U2. Now, if we now take this inner product, U1, and inner product of that with psi, what we have here as the first element, we, and now we insert for the psi this two component representation. Then what we get is basically U1, C1, U1, plus U1, C2, U2. We can take coefficients out. So it's U1 times inner product of U1 by itself plus C2 U1 U2. Now, two terms. What can you say about this term here?
It
is one. Yeah. And what about this term here?
Zero.
And why is this one and why is this zero?
Normal.
Yes. At least we assume because that is what it should be. So if they're orthonormal, then this is one, this is zero, and altogether this is C1. So we see that this component, first component, is basically coefficient of the first base function. The second component is a second coefficient, and so on. So in this matrix form, we have the coefficients of the basis functions, and same happens in the complex function.
Okay.
So now, so the inner product now in this formalism can be written in this way. So we take the row vector times the column vector. And you know how to calculate, hopefully, this. So you take the first element, multiply with the second element, plus second element with the second element of the row vector, and so on. And actually, we can, it's maybe useful to do this. Okay, so we have this row vector by U1 by U2, at the top, continuous, and then the column, same thing, U1 psi U2 and so on. So now let's take the first term. It's pi u1 times u1 psi plus, and we take the second pi u2. We pick second u2 psi plus just, and it continues. So and now we recognize that we have here always phi on the left, psi on the right, and in the middle we have u1, u1, u2, u2, 3, and so on. So clearly this is sum. So this is the sum over I. And phi, and then ui psi. Okay, so now you can see some. How can this simplify? Yeah, so we have a closure here, right? So this is one, so this is put together by psi, right? So that's the inner product. So here we see how in this matrix form, when we represent it here in this way, when we do the algebra, finally we have the closure there, and then you can see that this is just the inner product of psi with phi with psi. So that is an example where the closure can be observed. Now, and this is a number, as always. It's inner product. It's a number. Okay, so in quantum mechanics, operators are important. And we can represent operator in a matrix representation. And it's a bit complicated. So this is the operator A. And normally you would just write operator A operates on a function psi. But when we do matrix algebra, the representation of operator is like this. So it's a two, it's a n times m matrix where we have elements. So basically we have elements of the operator with all basis functions. So the indices go on diagonal, we have 1, 1, 2, 2, 3, 3, and so on, and then we have all possible elements of the operator with the basis functions. And why is it so? Just for Hermitian operators, which we have in quantum mechanics, quantum mechanical real systems, it's a complex conjugate of Ji is same as Ij. Now, this is just so that when we have this operator expression, that operator A operates on psi, and it gives phi, so something different. When we do this expression in a basis, in a new basis here, it looks like this. And now, so now you can do the algebra, and then you have to just calculate all these elements, and what you will get is the right hand side, which is again column vector, so it's a state, and we could also do this algebra, but maybe you can try yourself if you don't believe. But what happens is the same thing as what I just showed with inner product, that when you do the algebra, there is a closure and you will get the right hand side. The point is that in order for this to work, this operator must have this form so that it is sandwiched between the space states. Okay. Important equation is the eigenvalue equation. So for example, Schrödinger equation is like this. So we operate with A on our wave function or state psi, and we get the state back multiplied with the eigenvalue. And of course, for example, in spectroscopy, when we measure spectra, we probe the states, we probe the eigenstate. So whatever system you have, this could be, for example, vibrational system, oscillator, harmonic oscillator. If you operate, you will get the vibrational states, and eigenvalues are the energy of the states. And those are the energy levels or states which we probe in spectroscopy. So in Dirac notation, again, it looks like this. So, so we have the operator operating on psi, and we get the eigenvalue on the psi back. Now we just multiply from the left with the ui basis function. And again, if we insert the closure, so now in this time we insert it. So when you have something like this, a formula like this, you can just insert the closure. So we basically insert it between the operator A and psi. So we just put ket and bra of uj, put the sigma, so the sum. And this you can do. This is the same thing as upstairs there. And now we see better that this has appeared, this matrix form of the operator, right? So the matrix operator operates on psi in the basis, and it gives the eigenvalue and the psi back the base. And this is sometimes given in this shorter form. So sum over j of a with indices ij. So this means that this is the operator a in a basis where we have ij indices for the basis functions, operates on c, and cj, they are the coefficients of psi in the u basis, and it gives the eigenvalue times the coefficients. So this is a shorthand notation of what's upstairs there. So all this is basically dealing with the eigenvalue equation, which is Hamiltonian equation, but using this representation in a basis and the matrix algebra. So this is what we normally are interested in, Schrödinger equation, which gives total energy of the system. So it gives the energy states, and that's what we are interested in, the energy level structure of your molecules. And then a bit more philosophical question, which is that if the system is in an eigenstate, if you measure this system, it always gives you the same value, which is the eigenvalue. Okay. But if your system is not in the eigenstate, when you measure, you will get different values. So every time you get maybe different values. So there will be distribution of values. But when you do the average, the average of all the measurements is the expectation value, which is operator A sandwiched with psi. And that is the expectation value. And of course, if the system is in an eigenstate, then this reduces to the your eigenvalue. But this is important to understand that it is really so that if your system is not in an eigenstate, it gives different results, but the average result is the expectation value. Normally, when you do experiments, you are dealing with a huge number of molecules. And also, you don't perform like a single measurement of each molecule at the time, but you have a lot of measurements, you have a lot of photons which interact with a lot of molecules. So normally you always get the average or the expectation value in one shot, so to say. Okay, so that was about the algebra that we use to describe the theory of spectroscopy. So these are basically the important things. Now we go through a couple of model systems, and I try to refer how they reflect as simple models a spectroscopical system. So or something which we are interested in spectroscopy. And of course, one of the first systems to introduce in quantum mechanics is particle in a box. And so there we have a tightly confined system where we have infinite potential barrier. And what is nice here, this is one dimensional system, is that you can solve this exactly. So you can write down the exact form of the wave function. It is given here. It's very simple. And you can solve the Schrödinger equation, and the solution gives you the energy level spectrum. So, and here are the first four wave functions shown. And the energies are given as with index n. So we have basically one quantum number. So the first set, you plug in number one here. So it gives you h squared divided by h, 8 times n a squared, where a is the size of the box. So this is very nice, and it can be a fair approximation for some simple systems. And if it's a one-dimensional system, it's already some primitive model of a conjugated molecule. Like, you know, that if you have conjugated pi system, the electrons are delocalized over the molecule. So then it's a bit like a one-dimensional delocalized electron. And if you take the length of the molecule and use a particle in the box model, it gives not very accurate, but at least it's not too far. At least the order of magnitude of the energy levels is correct. And of course, it tells you that that when the size of the molecule or size of the box gets large, very large, the spacing between energy levels gets very small. Of course, natural. The smaller the system, the larger the spacing between energy levels. Now you can do three-dimensional box. You just take x, y, z, and then your wave function is basically product of three one-dimensional box wave functions with x, y, y and z. There is a problem here, but should be a product of box in x, y, and z direction. And energy is a sum of box energies in x, y, and z direction. Okay? And this is quite important principle. So if you have system where different degrees of freedom, in this case, x, y, and z coordinates, if they don't couple, so we can treat them independent. So we have just three-dimensional box, and they don't couple, so we can consider them separately. Then your wave function is a product of individual coordinate wave functions, and the energy is sum of the individual degrees of freedom wave functions. So you can calculate the total energy and total wave function. And now, then we already have again, fair primitive model for something like a nanoparticle. You just take metal nanoparticle. Here it's a rectangular, and you can plug in particle in a box dimensions, and you can calculate energy levels. And it turns out that, for example, that you can then investigate. What is the size of the box when energy level difference becomes so small that it can be considered a metal? And how small it should be, we can approximate, for example, in room temperature as an average thermal energy, which is a Kp. And it gives a fair description of such a situation. So it's not a bad model. So now we already learned that such a simple model can give a good idea already of conjugated molecules or metal nanoparticles, their energy level structure. The second model system is a harmonic oscillator. And harmonic oscillator is very, very useful for describing molecular vibrations. So when you measure infrared spectrum, for example, who has measured infrared spectrum? Okay, that is some of the more commonly used techniques. So you measure vibrations. We will come to this vibrational spectroscopy later. But a good model, in fact, fairly good model of vibration is harmonic oscillator. What is harmonic oscillator? It is a potential of this shape. So it's a parabolic potential. So that means it and the functional form is x squared, or the coordinate squared, x to the second power. So it's a parabola. So that means that you have you consider your system to be a system in parabolic potential. And of course, the completely mechanical analog is that you have ball going back and forth, but it's a model for spring, mechanical spring. So the potential energy, when you are at zero, you are at equilibrium of the spring. And when you stretch, you go to higher values, but potential energy increases quadratically. Or if you compress, the same thing. So why this is also a good model is that you can actually solve also Schrödinger equation for this system and get a wave function. So here is a form of wave function. It's a bit complicated, but it has two factors. One is n and one is h. This n is normalization factor. H is so-called Herbig polynomial. And these are tabulated. So these are known. And we have one index v, which is a vibrational quantum number. So of course, we have many solutions. And we give them index v, vibrational quantum number, which goes from zero to infinity. So wave functions are drawn here. And it is always such that the lowest one with the index zero is a Gaussian function. So that's a ground state. The second function has one node, next function has two nodes, and so on. So we know the wave functions, and we know the energy levels. So we have E with index V, and energy levels are particularly simple. So we have H bar omega. What is omega? Yes, which is 2 pi times nu. Nu is a linear thing. So it means one vibration per second, one frequency. And angular frequency is 2 pi. So it gives radians per second. Okay. And you remember I showed you the relations, which you have to remember. One of them was E is H bar omega or H nu. So that is the energy. It's present for energy. And then V plus half, where V is the quantum number, vibrational quantum number. And here we have the remarkable result. We have zero point energy. So at the ground state, system has half of H bar omega energy, not zero. This is always the case for potentials which are confined. There is some zero point energy. But the spacing between each level, between two subsequent levels, is always equal to H bar omega. Okay. So what does it mean for spectroscopy? The prediction would be that if you measure your vibrational spectrum for this vibration, you start from the ground state, and your first transition goes to V is one state. So it means that you would expect to see a peak in the spectrum at H bar omega, energy of H bar omega. And how much is H omega? It's given here. So omega is equal to square root of K divided by mu. And K, you see upstairs here, is property of the potential. So we call this a force constant. So K describes the stiffness of your potential. So the larger the K, the narrower this potential. If it's small, it gets broad, okay? So it makes sense. Frequency increases if you make your potential more confined, deeper. Okay. Then we have this alpha here, and that is, or we have mu. What is mu? It is a reduced mass. So when we consider this to be a spring system, we have two masses. So this is a particularly good model for diatomic molecules. So we have two masses connected by a spring, and this spring is described with this quadratic potential. And the two masses are masses of the atoms. So in this, but how to treat two masses in this is that we use so-called reduced mass, which is given by M1 times M2 divided by M1 plus M2. So by plugging in these two masses, we get so-called reduced mass. And the idea is that then we can consider this as just single mass moving in this potential. Okay, so if you have diatomic molecule with two masses, you can calculate mu. Okay. And then, of course, you have to know the potential form. Then, if you give, you are given a potential, then you can calculate what is the angular frequency, and then you can predict where your chances will be. Okay. So, and this alpha is given here. It's a k mu divided by h pi squared in square root, and this is a trick that we do in order to get these in simple forms. Okay. Now, I give you some relations because we use, in Kelly book in particular, we use so-called lowering and raising operators. And I need to introduce a couple of relations for that. So, reduced coordinates, Q is a spatial coordinate, position coordinate, but it is given with this relation. So X is basically real spatial coordinate where we are, but we use Q, which is given by this relation, and P is momentum, and it is given by this relation. So it is just a trick which helps to get simpler results in the end. The idea is that I just gave you the wave function and the energy level spectrum, but we didn't derive it. So you have to solve the Schrödinger equation to get them. And here is the Hamiltonian. So Hamiltonian is in reduced coordinates, looks like this. So it's just a half times h bar omega times momentum operator squared plus position operator squared in reduced coordinates. And now it looks quite simple. And now we introduce these lowering and raising operators. This is just the definition. So the lowering operator A is given by this expression where we have, it's a combination of position and momentum operators. And the raising operator is otherwise the same, but we have Q plus IP, Q minus IP, and for the lowering operator, Q plus IP. You don't have to worry about this, but the result is more important. So now, if we write the position operator in terms of lowering and raising operators, it looks like this. So now it's the sum of lowering and raising operators, and position operator is A minus A dagger, which is a lowering minus raising operator. And what is the real value of these operators is that when we operate on harmonic oscillator states, they give particularly simple results. So the first line shows you what happens when lowering operator operates on harmonic oscillator state with index p. So this can be any 0, 1, 2, whatever. So let's say that this is a state 3. Okay. What happens is that it gives you square root of V. So the result is square root of 3 times 1 less index of vibrational state. So V state becomes V minus one state. So if V was free, it would be that it gives you from free state, it gives square root of three times state two. But this is very simple algebra. Finally, so you go down, down, down. And finally, when you operate on a zero state, the result is zero, so you cannot go lower. And the raising operator works similarly, but it raises the quantum state by one. So if you operate on V state, it gives you back V plus one state. So if it operates on state number three, it gives you state number four multiplied by V plus one. So this is square root of two, but it's two times state four. So these are very simple relations which are useful later when you calculate something. This we don't have to worry. And in particular, the Hamiltonian now, when you use this, becomes so simple. So it's only given in terms of raising and lowering operators, where this A dagger A is given the symbol N. Okay. So this is just some algebra, and usually I have had a demo exercise where you use this. So I guess also this time there will be. All right, now, so basically what we had particle in a box, which is a good model for simple electronic systems like a conjugated molecule or metal nanoparticle. And then we had a harmonic oscillator, which is a good model system for molecular vibration. Now, of course, we go to more advanced electronic state systems, and hydrogen atom is an important one. When you go to electronic spectroscopy, we probe electronic states of molecules. And in order to understand electronic states, we have to understand molecular orbitals. And molecular orbitals consist of atomic orbitals. And that's why we need to understand atomic orbitals well. So hydrogen atom is a great system because you can solve Schrödinger equation for it and you get the energy spectrum and wave functions. The mathematical effort is considerable, so of course we don't do it. But the point is that the wave function of a hydrogen atom can be given with this expression, where we have a product of two functions, R and Y. And R is so-called radial function, so it depends only on distance. So that's why it has R coordinate only. And the angular function depends on two angular coordinates, theta and phi. And we have three quantum numbers, N, L, and M. So basically, three indices define your wave function out of that. Okay. So we have set of wave functions. And these indices, these quantum numbers, go so that n, the principal quantum number, goes from one to infinity. So it can be one, two, three, four, blah, blah, blah. The L quantum number can take value from zero, one, two, and so on, up to n minus one. So if n is free, L can take values 0, 1, 2, because 3 minus 1 is 2, so it goes up to 2. Okay. And m, quantum number, can take values from minus L up to plus L. So here in this case, if we had L 2, we would have m values minus 2. Minus 2 plus 1, 1, 0, sorry, minus 2, minus 1, 0, 1, and 2. Okay? And what are these? Well, the energies we get from this expression where we have only the principal quantum number n. And so what we get here, we call them orbital. So orbital is a wave function. And there is just one trick that px and py orbitals are taken as linear combination of spherical harmonics. So it's not simply directly the this wave function, but the linear combination of them. But we don't have to worry about that too much. But here's how they look like. So these are familiar to you. S orbital is a wave function, atomic wave function. And we have three p orbitals. And now, what can you tell about these three wave functions? So what differs in them in terms of quantum number? We have m, l, and m. So, so here the n is one, l is zero, it has no components. Here l is one, and l can have three components of m, which is minus one, zero, or one. So these are the those wave functions. They have the same energy, but the different direction. So basically this m quantum number tells you the direction of this. Is different. That's what they are. These are the d orbitals. So we have five of them because what is L quantum number for d orbital? Two. And we can have five different m values, minus two, minus one, zero, one, and two. And here are the orbitals. Okay. Good. So, of course. So these are the atomic orbitals, and we construct the molecular orbitals from them. So it's good to understand what atomic orbitals are. We have an electron spin, which is also important in spectroscopy. And if we have a single electron spin, it can have basically two states. We can call them up or down spin or alpha or beta spin. So in principle, for a single electron, it's quite simple. We have two states. But of course, in molecules, we have many electrons. We have to consider many spins. It's important to realize that it is a form of angular momentum. So whenever we have angular momentum in quantum mechanics, same kind of algebra applies. However, we have an operator for spin. So we have S, or often we use S squared. So this is a spin operator, and we have a Z component of the spin. And we have two states, alpha or beta. Note that there is no spatial coordinate here. No, there is no coordinate. It's just the state. So alpha state, when we operate on alpha with the S squared, which is the spin operator, we get alpha back multiplied by with this factor. When we operate on beta, we get beta back with the same factor. So no change there. It's just the Z component which is different. So if we operate with Z component SD on alpha, we get h power per half alpha. If we operate on beta, we get minus h power per half. To beta. So this is the idea of two states. And they are orthonormal. Right? So now, if we consider electronic wave function, now we have two things. We have spatial wave function, which is for atoms, it's an atomic orbital. For molecules, molecular orbital. But we have also spin part. And we have to form the total wave function. And that is a product of space and spin parts. We can write it in this way. If we have a single electron, single spin, we have a total wave function as a function of coordinates r, theta, phi, sigma, which is our spin coordinate. So we have a spatial part and it can have a product with alpha spin or beta spin. So we have two possibilities. But now if we have two electrolysis, there is very stringent restriction that the total wave function must be antisymmetric with respect to permutation of electrons. So what is permutation? Permutation is that you switch the indices of the electrons. Basically, you switch them. Number one, number two becomes number two, number one. The wave function must change sign. This is a very strange phenomenon. So we can have that if we have single spatial wave function sign. So both electrons must be there with on the same spatial wave function. So only one possibility. So we have electron one and electron two are there. But now that one, this is a spatial wave function. This is symmetric. It doesn't change if we switch one and two. So now we have to consider the spin part. Spin part here is written in such a way that it is antisymmetric. So we have alpha spin, electron one has alpha spin and electron two beta minus electron one has beta spin, electron two alpha spin. This is allowed form of the wave function. If I would write only alpha one, beta two and nothing else, it is not appropriate because it is not symmetric or antisymmetric. If I switch the indices for electrons, it doesn't give me minus or plus back. So it's nothing. So it's written in this way. And now you see that if I switch these, if I permutate this, this becomes alpha 2 beta 1 and plus. And here we have alpha 2 beta 1 minus. So it changes sign. And if I permute here, I will have minus beta 2 alpha 1, which is minus this here. So now it changes sign. So this is a proper wave function. Spatial part times spin part. Okay. So if we have many electron systems, there is an automatic way to actually antisymmetrize the wave function. So it is a sort of stated determinant. And you write these orbitals in terms of a determinant, and that gives you automatically antisymmetric result. But let's not go to that. Now if we But we had one orbital now, spatial orbital, but we have two different orbitals. And that applies to situation, for example, excited state of a molecule. So we promote electron from occupied orbital to non-occupied orbital. So in this situation, then we have, let me write. So we have many orbitals. These are electrons. And this is non-occupied orbital. So we do excitation. And now we can have something like this. Electrons on different orbitals with up spin. Or we can have something like this, up and down spins, or vice versa. So this is a excited state of a molecule. So how does it look now? Now we have two spatial orbitals given by psi and phi. And now we have to do the same thing as with the spin. So we have to write it as a combination of psi one phi two plus phi one psi two, and the same for the spin part. And now we can for both. We can have plus combination or minus combination. So it is either symmetric or antisymmetric with respect to permutation of electrons, both the space part and the spin part. But you remember that the total wave function should be antisymmetric. So we must combine them in such a way that total wave function is antisymmetric. So if I have a symmetric spacer wave function, it has to combine with anti-symmetric spin part. So then it looks like this. This is the wave function for the spatially symmetric but spin anti-symmetric spin function. And then for the opposite case, where we have a spatially anti-symmetric function, the spin function must be symmetric. And we in fact have three different possibilities for that. First one is this plus combination, and the second one is alpha one, alpha two. Because if I permute this, it is the same. It is symmetric. Or beta one, beta two. So there are three wave functions. And now we call this first one, we call singlet. And three next cases, we call triplet. And these are very much used terms in spectroscopy and photochemistry in particular. We call singlet state or triplet state. Basically, this one is a triplet state. It has a same spin for both. For example, alpha one, alpha two. Both have the same spin. Or beta one, beta two, down, down. And then we have this combination. So in reality, triplet state is three different states, but usually they are degenerate or close to degenerate. So the energies are the same or almost the same. And we think them as single state with double degenerate. So that is what is the so-called singlet state or triplet state. Okay, now very important approximation, Born-Oppenheimer. This is in spectroscopy. Very important. So electrons are three orders of magnitude or more lighter than nuclei, and they are much, much faster. So nuclei are very slow, electrons are very fast. Anything happening with electrons is extremely fast. Nuclei are slower, so we can separate the motions. So when starting from the Hamiltonian, we have a you remember Hamiltonian's total energy. So it has kinetic energy, which is T, and potential energy, which is V, and potential energy is electrostatic Coulomb interaction. So we have five terms, kinetic energy of electrons, kinetic energy of nuclei, potential energy, electron nucleus, electron nucleus, nucleus. And now what we do is we assume static nuclei. So let's freeze them and solve the electronic Schrodinger equation. So what happens is that we write psi e, so we solve for the electron wave function. And now we have the electron kinetic energy and electron nucleus, electron potential energy. And we fix the position for the nuclei, and then we have a constant term for their nuclear repulsor. So this gives us electronic wave function. So that is our molecular orbitals. Now what we do is that, but remember this is for the single nuclear configuration, usually equilibrium configuration, so equilibrium structure of the molecule. But then what we do is that we move the nuclei. We, for example, for diatomic molecule, we stretch and solve again for the electronic wave function. And again, and again, and again. And we get representation of electronic energy as a function of nuclear coordinate. For the diatomic molecule, it would look like this. Okay. So here is the equilibrium structure. And when you stretch, the potential energy rises, but in the end, when you go far enough, it's constant. So they don't feel anymore each other. And then the molecule has dissociated. When you compress, you get strong repulsion because you cannot squeeze the atoms to each other. And now this is our potential energy, electron potential energy, where nuclei move. And this resembles harmonic oscillator. It would look like this. And so in the bottom, it's a good model, harmonic oscillator is a good model. But in principle, now we solve Schrödinger equation for nuclear motion in this potential, which is the electronic energy. Okay. So now we do this. Now we have nuclear kinetic energy, nucleus potential energy, and EE, which is electronic energy, which I just draw. Okay. And nuclear wave function, and we get nuclear functions and energies. And the simple model is a harmonic oscillator, but if we do it properly, we will get anharmonic oscillator energies, and we get vibrational wave functions. So in this way, we can solve both, and we separate the wave function of the total wave function. Total wave function is a product of electronic wave function times nuclear wave function. And the energy, total energy, is sum of these energies. Now, nuclear motion, and this was just a vibration, but we have other nuclear motions. We have rotation and translation, and we have electron spin. So we can, all of them can be separated, and the total wave function is a product of electronic wave function, vibrational wave function, rotational wave function, spin wave function. Okay. But the good point here is that this total energy sum of these. So that means that we can basically solve separately for each. It simplifies considerably. And the good point is that this is a very good approximation. So it gives quite accurate results. But of course, it's not the complete truth, because you cannot expect that they are totally separated. It is for sure this nuclear motion somehow affects a bit the electron motion. And these are the interesting effects that we see in spectroscopy. And that is one topic that needs to be understood in more advanced spectroscopy. So much of this separation, it gives you good results. You can understand most of the things, but in reality, you have coupling between different motions, and this leads to interesting effects in the spectra, in the level structure, and these are more advanced techniques then. Okay, so that is now basically the necessary background for continuation. So basically, Born-Oppenheimer approximation tells you that we can treat separately electron motion, vibrational motion, rotational motion, and spin. And that leads to us to the philosophy that we treat them separately. We can consider electronic spectroscopy, vibrational, rotational, and then we consider in more advanced treatment that how they are coupled and what kind of effects it leads. And we have good models for each of them. For electronic motion, we have either particle in a box or atomic orbitals, and we form molecular orbitals from them. And that gives us a way to understand molecular electronic energy levels. Then vibrational motion, we have a harmonic oscillator. For rotational motion, we did not discuss, but that is just a simple rotor motion. And then spin is just, we just already represented how we treat the spin. So that is all about the basis for doing spectroscopy. We probe these energy levels in different electromagnetic experiments. Okay, I think we can have a 5-minute break now, and then we still continue for some time with the electromagnetic radiation a little bit more compared to the Tuesday lecture. But let's have a small break, 5 minutes, so we continue at 5:30. You can melt this part. So now we continue, and we go back to electromagnetic radiation and discuss this in more detail then during the first lecture. So this follows now the Kelly book chapter 2. So on first lecture I already showed mathematical formula for the electromagnetic radiation. Here's a slightly different kind of representation of that. So it looks very complicated. But let's see how it looks. So of course we have E, which is the electric field, and we have H, which is the magnetic field, but let's concentrate on electric field as our last study. So let's see what we have. So we have first bracket, we have vector E1, this is a unit vector, and this is shows the direction. This is a polarization direction. Then we have E0, that is a amplitude of electric field and divided by two. So the first part is simple. Then we have a next bracket is consists of two parts, two exponential functions, E to I, and in parentheses omega t minus k dot r. And the second one is almost the same, but it is E minus the same thing. So it is E something plus E minus something, okay? And here we have, you see that what we have in exponential, it looks very much similar to what we had in the cosine representation of oscillating, like the omega t, so angular frequency times the time, and then k dot r. So this is a k is a wave vector this time. On last lecture, it was a scalar k because we had only one direction, one coordinate. Now it's a vector k, okay? So it's a same as wave number, but now with the direction. And dot r is a position in space. So the difference is that we have any arbitrary direction of propagation and point in space. Okay, but what now we have to understand this exponent representation. And they can be understood from Euler's formulas, which are down here. So E to I phi is same as cosine phi plus I sine phi. And E to minus I phi is same as cosine phi minus I sine phi. So altogether, if we write E to I phi plus E to minus I phi, we see that this is cosine phi plus I sine phi plus cosine phi minus I sine phi. So we see that this imaginary component vanishes, and this is two times cosine phi. And now we see the logic why we use this exponential representation is that it actually same as cosine, two times cosine. So this is another way of representing cosine function. And so it is equivalent to the expression we gave, where we had the cosine omega t k x or k dot r. So the reason is that it looks now much more difficult, but when you do algebra, when you multiply these functions, it is much easier to perform with exponential functions than with cosine functions. So in the end, it is easier than with cosine functions. So now from now on, you just have to remember, realize that this part is same as cosine omega t k dot r minus k dot r. It's just a more complicated representation. So now if we plug in that, then we have the same kind of expression as on the first lecture. And it represents propagating oscillating electric field. Now this wave vector, now it's vector, and it is the direction of the vector is the direction of propagation, and the magnitude is okay, is, as we learned, it's 2 pi per lambda, so it's inverse of lambda. Okay, so if you know where your beam is propagating, you know the direction of your wave vector. And the wave vector has also another relation, or the magnitude of the wave vector, the wave number, is given with in terms of fundamental constants, permittivity and permeability. And then we have also the phase velocity, v. It's a speed of light divided by n, which is a refractive index. So basically, the speed of propagation depends on a refractive index. And now we come to something which can be measured. So energy density, energy per unit volume, average over multiple cycles of theory. So what does it mean? It means that since we know that this oscillation of the electric field is extremely fast, and it's something that we cannot measure in real time. We don't have a detector which could measure at any moment the energy. So we take average field, average energy of the oscillating electric field. It is quite simple expression. It is electric field amplitude squared times the permittivity. So this is a simple expression. And now we use a couple of relations that permittivity is relative permittivity times vacuum permittivity, and epsilon r is same as n squared refractive index. So now we have a practical expression for average energy density, energy per unit volume, vacuum permittivity, refractive index squared, and electric field amplitude divided by 2. Now, well, it's not so easy to measure how much we have energy per some volume here. It's much easier to measure how much energy hits a surface, because if you think about measuring that, you have a detector and the light comes to the detector with some area and you measure how much energy is deposited per time. So then we need this flux, energy flux across the surface, perpendicular to k, which is a propagation. So for example, we have a laser beam and we have a detector, and we want to measure how much energy per unit time is hitting the surface. This is how you do the laser beam energy measurement. It's given, the flux is given by the pointing vector, and this gives energy density times the speed of light. So basically, how much there's energy and how fast it travels. And that is so energy density times speed of light. This is intensity. Okay. And now we just plug in the energy density and speed of light, which was, we have to remember, we have to divide by n, refractive index. And finally, come to this expression where the intensity of light, something you can measure, is vacuum permittivity, refractive index, speed of light, and electric field amplitude. So if you measure the intensity of your beam or light or laser beam, you can calculate what is the electric field amplitude of your light. And that is the intensity of radiation. And it is the energy per unit time per unit area. So basically, joules per square meter, more often we per second. So or watt per square meter. Quite often we use watts per square centimeter. Okay. So that is something very useful. So it gives you immediately a view on the amplitude of electric field when you just measure your intensity of your light. And then you can think of magnitude of electric field compared to the electric forces within the molecule or atom. It's very insightful. Okay, then there is very important relation between the frequency distribution of your light and the time distribution of your light with concerning the pulse experiments. I will explain better. But when we had this description of electromagnetic field, we had just one single frequency. But this can never be in reality. There is always some kind of distribution. It's not just one single discrete frequency. So it is always some distribution. It can be narrow distribution, but it's always some distribution and polarization. For example, here we have all kinds of polarizations. So we need a bit more complicated expression. So this is more general expression where we have the same thing as previously. We have exponent terms. And now in this expression, the CC means complex conjugate. So you just put the minus here. So this means e to I phi plus e to minus I phi. So this is just a simplifying thing. CC, complex conjugate of this. Okay, and then you have the electric field amplitude E, but now it's not just single one, but it is has two indices, alpha, and alpha we have also in this unit vector, so that is the direction, polarization. So we have, and it's sum over alpha, so we have different directions, different polarizations, and we have K, so the wave number, and we have the same index for the omega, so frequency. So we have different frequencies with index k and sum over them. So we now in this expression, we have different frequencies, different polarizations, and sum over all of them. So this is more general expression. Okay. So now from this more general expression, we go back to more simple expression. So let's assume that we have a one point in space, so we can forget about the space part. And first we start with the same one polarization component. And now we think that we have a lot of waves with similar frequencies. And instead of sum, we use integral because we have lots of them. So we can basically use now convert this sum to integral, and we drop the sum over polarization because we think one polarization component, and we replace this sum over k with the integral over omega, so different frequencies. So now our electric field as a function of time, of electric field, is now this integral over different frequency components times amplitude and this exponential part. And the complex conjugate again, and we can consider special cases where this can be solved. Okay, only one frequency present. So now we return back to this simple. So let's we have only one frequency, and then our frequencies are just one amplitude and delta function at a certain frequency, and you can do this integral with this kind of delta function. If you plug it in, the result is like this. So the result is that electric field in function of time is actually same as previous, so it's a e times cosine, so we have a complex conjugate, it's e times cosine omega t, so that is a monochromatic wave, but note that this was, we had to use this imaginary delta function for the frequencies, and intensity average of the multiple size is constant in time. So it's basically everywhere in time. It's not cut anywhere. And now second special case, all frequencies are present with equal amplitudes. So all possible frequencies, just that distribution. And now we can represent this E as a function of omega, just as a constant E, because everything's E everywhere. And we plug it in. What we are doing here is that we plug it into this E omega. So now we just put E there and we integrate. We integrate, and the result is like this. It is pi times E times delta function in time. So if you have all possible frequencies occurring simultaneously, then it is infinitely sharp peak in time. So it's infinitely sharp pulse. This is interesting. So you see that first case where we have delta peak in frequency means that it's everywhere, the wave is everywhere in time. Or if we have all possible frequencies, it is infinitely sharply in time. So monochromatic wave is completely delocalized in time. And if frequency is completely undefined, there is perfect localization in time. But you never reach this in practice. So we have something in between always. And more then there something between, we can consider Gaussian distribution of frequencies with the central frequency omega zero and standard deviation of sigma. That means the width of the Gaussian. Okay. So now we have the functional form for the electric frequency in terms of Gaussian distribution. We put the normalization factor. So now we plug it into the equation for the integral and solve the integral. And so it looks like this. This is a normalization factor. And this is the integral. And now in the integral, we have e to this one where we have omega squared. So this is a Gaussian function. This is a now Gaussian function of frequency, okay, with the sigma. And then we have all these time exponents here. And this can be solved, and it gives this result. You see that it is, again, we have a oscillating part, but it gives you Gaussian function in time. So distribution of frequencies gives distribution of times. So that means that we have come to so-called frequency time uncertainty principle, which applies very much to the femtosecond spectroscopy and pulse later. Frequency distribution becomes narrower, the pulse becomes broad, and vice versa. If you do a calculation, so now you can model this, you can calculate the Gaussian, different Gaussian functions, and here is your pulse envelope in time, different versions of it, and equivalent frequency distribution. So for example, let's take this outer envelope, solid line. It is broad in time, and that is sharp in frequency. But the one which is short pulse in time is broadest in frequency. It means that if you want to make short pulses, you must have a broad spectrum. You must have a lot of frequencies. And the shorter pulse you want, the more frequency you have to have. You cannot make short pulse from very monochromatic light. That is the key point. And in general, this is an example of a Fourier transform relations. This is a general form. We have a function as a in X. And we do Fourier transform, which is the integral of this function as a function of x, and then multiplied with exponential with x and alpha, and then you return, you get back function in different coordinates. In this time, frequency and time are Fourier transform pairs. So you can convert between frequency and time. Okay, I think I will stop here. And do you have any questions? No questions. So now hopefully I can get this video stored so you can look. I have already put the slides in Moodle, and I will put today the demo exercises, and you should return them by Tuesday night. And so we will continue next week on Tuesday, and that will be about the experimental techniques, spectroscopy. Thank you.